What's going on? I can't travel to Durban, and I really need to see the team. Our telephone bill is through the roof, our server crashed, and we've lost all our files.
Are you getting frustrated with problems in your business? Win at work and calm the chaos with Voxel's intelligent business solutions. Work smarter, not harder, and connect your business to the world from 899 Rand. Please and see the try. Visit vox.co.za for more information.
How flexible is your device? Are you a person on the move and need your device to move with you? The Mesa Fundi goes wherever you go. It allows you to take notes, sketch your great ideas, sign documents and get work done wherever you are. Attach Microsoft Office for the ultimate experience. Make the shift and upgrade to the Mesa Fundi with Windows 10 Professional. The Mesa Fundi, flexibility reimagined. Available online and in store at all leading retailers. Mesa recommends Windows 10 Professional. Visit mesa.co.za for more information.
I'm Duncan MacLeod, and this is Tech Central. I'm joined now by Miriam Altman, a commissioner at the National Planning Commission, a former chief strategy officer at Telkom, and director of Altman Advisory, for a wide-ranging discussion on the lockdown and what needs to happen to minimize the economic fallout. Miriam, welcome to the podcast. I think let's start with your work with the National Planning Commission and the crafting of the National Development Plan. I was looking at your LinkedIn page, and I was amazed to see that the commission was created 10 years ago now. Doesn't feel like that long. The commission has been fairly quiet lately. What work is it doing these days, and is it still meeting regularly?
Yeah, no, we are. I admit we've been quiet, and I'm often apologizing in public for that. It's a government-related agency. And communications is reliant on how government wants to communicate, I guess. So, as you know, we wrote the plan, which was approved by all parties in Parliament and Cabinet in 2012. What we've been doing in this term, I was reappointed in 2015, and what we're doing in this term is more looking at implementation. Now, the reality is that the period up to a couple of years ago was rough, and I guess we were actually active and working quietly behind the scenes, but it was rough for everybody. And this period has been about, particularly our terms end this year. Our work right now focuses on what has been delivered towards the plan. Now, as you know, the Planning Commission is not responsible for implementing the plan. A lot of people get confused about that. It's about all of us actually delivering against that. Having said that, the focus of the work that certainly I'm involved in and many of my colleagues are involved in is very much focused, let's be honest, on what the state's delivered. So I'm leading, I'm leading an economic review of delivery against the plan, which focuses on infrastructure, state-owned enterprise delivery, digital readiness, education for the economy, energy and energy supplier industries that could be stimulating the economy, and macroeconomics.
That's a lot.
Yes, it's a lot. We're going to have about 12 papers coming through, one of which was already released related to infrastructure. The focus of that work, and I appreciate that you're asking me this because our communications haven't been strong. I accept that. And I hope that in the next few months that's really going to change dramatically. We issued a paper, and it's on our website. We do actually have a publications website, and the paper's posted there, the draft paper, and we'll issue a final paper. And all of the papers will focus on the institutional capacity of the state, which we think is the most critical barrier to progress right now. It doesn't mean it's the only thing we have to think about, naturally, we have to be thinking about civil society and business contribution. But the reality is, like around infrastructure, there is money available. It's not all spent. And the question is, why doesn't it get spent? Why don't we get the result we're after? So all of the work that we're looking at is what's within our power to do. How do we rebuild capacity? How do we get the state functioning better? Even state capture notwithstanding, there are all kinds of institutional things that could be improved. You know, you and I have been for years discussing, like when I was at Telecom, the role of the National Broadband Plan. It was one of the first projects that I worked on when I went to Telecom, was to frame a proposal for obvious reasons, because Telecom, well, has and had the largest fiber network. And at that time, one could have built out, you know, this was 2013, if you remember, that's when I went there. I think you might have interviewed me when I first went there.
Yes.
So, you know, we had proposals to link up all government buildings to the fiber network and maybe create a social co. You know, because people were worried about the governance and competition issues. You know, the reality is, I'm not sure that a lot has happened in relation to connecting government buildings since then. And in ensuring that the other half of the population gets fully connected in the same way that you'd find in China or Vietnam. And there is so much the private sector does in that realm. But over the years, I give a lot of talks about this, that states generally don't understand digital very well. Generally, they don't. And there's an assumption that the private sector delivers, but the state's really got to step in and get moving in relation to getting closer to where Vietnam or China is. So anyway, just to come back to the NPC, our focus right now is to say, so in areas where we can agree on delivery areas, where there is budget, there is commitment, what happens? Why don't we progress? And what would be the elements of course correction to make a difference now? We think that that is the highest impact role we as the NPC could have right now.
Yeah. I'm interested in I think maybe let's go back a little bit to the technology discussion and the National Broadband Plan, et cetera. It's quite amazing that that you and I can be sitting in our respective homes in lockdown having this conversation, and that's largely as a result of the private sector deploying fiber infrastructure in the cities in South Africa. I would hate to have to live through this lockdown on old school telecom ADSL infrastructure. There's been huge investment by the private sector in fiber broadband. Now, it obviously hasn't expanded outside the cities into the smaller towns, into the rural areas, et cetera. But the private sector has done amazing work in providing broadband connectivity in the cities. You say the state has a role to play. I imagine when you say that, you're talking specifically about connecting areas where perhaps it doesn't make economic sense or financial sense for the private sector to roll out that infrastructure, so into more rural parts of the country.
Yeah, you know, my concern, and it's true right across Africa, you know, it works well if you're well-to-do or maybe upper middle class. It works well if you're a corporate, you know, in an urban area. Doesn't work so well if you're lower income. If you're not in the center of a city, it's not so great. That's true right across Africa. So there's absolutely no reason why, you know, we're still at maybe, what is it, about 60% internet penetration? And even there, you know, it's a mixed bag how much is actually used. Or you might even say 30% are true broadband users.
Yeah.
You know, off the top of my head, I'm guessing.
Yeah, probably in that ballpark. Yeah.
You could say 60% use it. But, you know, I don't think you'd say that they are, you know, truly e-savvy and capable.
Yeah.
And this is what happens when you're in a place that is highly unequal, where you have very low income, and there is a private benefit to being online, but there's also a public benefit to everybody. From the perspective of everything from the expansion of e-commerce, e-government services, and bringing the cost of living down as the NDP envisaged. You know, if everybody had been online through this period, COVID would have been a very different story in its management. The ability to get services to people, money, payments, informal e-retailing, it would have been very different. And so it just exposes that difference. Now, when you have a very large proportion of the population that is very poor, remember 25% of people fall below what's called the food poverty line, which means that they can't even put a proper food basket together for their family. And about 50% of people, almost 50% of people fall below the next level of poverty line, which is, you know, they can eat, but don't have much else. Mm. Very, very vulnerable. That means the state needs to step in, which it does, around grants and a range of services, but it needs to step in to make sure that that the population does have access in the way that, let's take Vietnam as an example. You know, China is so extreme in relation to the extent it's rolled out, but let's look at Vietnam that's done extraordinary things. You know, I sometimes tell the story that about 10 years ago, a group of economists and the Planning Commission from Vietnam visited South Africa, and I hosted them at the HSRC. And you know, they said, we've got so much to learn from you. And I thought, wow, you know, like what I presented to them was, we have something to learn from you. Because at that time, they had about a quarter of our per capita income. It's now about a third. So it was a low-income country, about a quarter of our per capita income, but they had the same level of human development index. And that included 3 times the internet penetration in the home for a poor country. That's a choice that is made. If you go to Vietnam now, I don't know if you've been there recently.
I've never been to Vietnam, actually.
Well, you know, the impact of that and that commitment, it's created a situation of everybody being online, an e-savvy population, extremely low cost and affordable broadband, even for a foreigner who's visiting. Mm-hmm. To give you an idea, I think I can, you know, most people don't connect to this stuff, but, you know, you're on a tech show. I was there 2 Octobers ago, so I guess it's, 2018. I paid $9 for 2 gigabytes of data, you know, plus phone calls that was renewed every day for 30 days.
2 gigabytes a day for 30 days.
Yes, renewed every day. For the same package on a month, I pay about $40 in China. I have a number in China. Mm-hmm. I have a Chinese number because I'm in and out of China quite a lot. Not this year, but, you know, otherwise. So I pay about, as a foreigner, I pay about $40. So they extract from you. In South Africa, that would not be expensive. By comparison to $9 for 2 gigs a day, renewed every day, plus voice. I mean, normally I don't go into that detail, but I think your listeners probably would relate to that.
Sure.
You know, it was extraordinary. And I got it. I arrived at 10 o'clock at night. I walked into a store. I was out of there within minutes with my SIM enabled, using my Google Maps. So enabled. Right?
It's interesting. I mean, we all know how dysfunctional many of South Africa's state-owned enterprises are. We know that many aspects of government, national and municipal level, are dysfunctional in South Africa. Are we expecting too much of the state if we expect them to roll out infrastructure to provide broadband access to people? Is this something the South African government is actually capable of doing, or should there be a much bigger role for the private sector, perhaps through the forms of subsidies, through the Universal Service Fund and other mechanisms?
Well, you know, I lean less to the Universal Service Fund. And I don't think government should be doing it. And the entities, many of the entities are strained, and certainly the ones in this space. Government's got to do certain things just as a bottom line. We've got to get onto digital migration.
Yeah.
That's an example of something, you know, everybody can agree that it needs to be done. We've got to release spectrum. You can auction the spectrum if you like, but a good deal of it isn't actually available.
Yeah, I mean, there's a good case in point. We're 5 years beyond the deadline. The government seems to be incapable of even managing a project as relatively simple as digital migration. Can it really be entrusted with the role of building a national broadband network?
Well, it has to. And so the challenge, and let's not say that they need to build a national broadband network. They need to make sure that broadband is available to everybody affordably. People know what to do with it. They have low-cost handsets. You know, that's why I'm giving Vietnam as a good example, because it may be more analogous to us as a country.
Okay.
So now there's a sense that government's going to do this national broadband plan. I increasingly think it should procure it as a service and not as a capital project. It's something when I left Telkom that I was proposing to them, actually. And it was something that the budget office and treasury was interested in. But, you know, everybody's changed. All the people moved. But I think now what would make a lot of sense is for government to procure the broadband service and the hookup of government offices as a service rather than as a capital project. So it sits on that part of the budget. The reality is that the Department of Telecommunications has never actually had a very big capital budget. Mm-hmm. And at this point, given the changes in capability and technology, I think it would be better to call it OPEX rather than CAPEX.
Right.
Right? And enable departments, you know, just have norms and standards around how it should be done and let them hook up. Would be the thing. You can't expect is that you're going to end up with, say, an excellent road network by incentivizing construction companies through a universal service fund. Yeah, just by analogy, you know, you wouldn't roll out water or roads to poor communities that don't have voice with obligations on the back of some kind of licensing arrangement. Right? Mm-hmm. Government has never been effective at getting firms to keep to their commitments around the USOs. So what you would rather do is you would rather have decisions made about the kind of network you'd want to see and government procuring, you know, with SLAs and done appropriately around areas that really will not be covered commercially. Is the point. Mm-hmm. And then there are a whole range of competition issues around pricing. I still quite can't, even with the Competition Commission report, I still can't quite wrap my head around why broadband's still expensive, even with the price reductions. I can't quite get the right answer as to why we're so different from a place like Vietnam as an example, because these are globally traded services. These things should even out globally in relation to what they cost.
If you listen to the operators, the argument is that every country is different in terms of taxation, in terms of population densities. It's always been argued that, you know, Hong Kong, for example, was able to get very, very cheap fiber broadband because everyone lived in high-rise apartment blocks. And you talk to the operators here, they'll argue that the prices can't be as cheap as they are in some densely populated areas because they have to build infrastructure right across the country, including in the rural Karoo, et cetera, which adds to the cost. That's the argument.
Well, do you have to lay fiber underground?
No, you don't.
You know, I mean, just giving an example. The one thing, it's something I write about sometimes, is that we're always looking for first world, top of the line approaches to roll out when throwing fiber over a wall might be good enough. Mm. You know, having reasonable handsets would be good enough. You know, the issue is you want to get access. You know, Duncan, in part of my life, I do a lot of work with young people. Mm-hmm. And I set up a program that works with youth leadership in high schools. One of the things I learned, which was not completely surprising to me, but just brought it home. I worked with youth leaders, like really top youth leaders in Ekurhuleni, when I left Telcom. And one of the things that is a take home is you're talking about super smart. You know, a lot of these kids end up low-income communities, but they do end up UCT and top-tier programs. But they're not e-enabled at all. They don't have a smartphone. They don't know how to get really to get online. They can't find their way around. They never have data. They're really not e-savvy. And I'm speaking about a kind of elite group of kids from low-income communities. And that's Akar Leni, which is pretty central in Gauteng. So I won't say that I'm shocked, but it's that personal engagement where you realize, you know, I have to guide them through the download of this type of an app that we're on now.
Right.
So that we would have discussions, because they never have transport money, they never have data. It's not surprising. But they're just not e-savvy at all. Now that's not going to take us anywhere. That's not going to, that doesn't help them, and it doesn't help the country. So just to take an example, one of the things I did, you know, some of the kids would say, oh, I'm applying for university now, and they're thinking of doing, you know, generally their idea of, say, engineering, this is the level of kid I'm talking about.
Yeah.
You know, they're applying for engineering, but they're thinking industrial engineering or construction. Or, I said, that's okay, you can do that, but why aren't you thinking about data analytics and electronic engineering? You know, think about it at least, and they don't know what I'm talking about. So, you know, one of the things I did one year is I took them to Barry at Chimalakong, who I'm sure everybody knows, who are your listeners. And we did a session with some young robotics engineers. In fact, I hooked in my nephew is a robotics engineer, and his girlfriend was one also. They're 25 years old, very cool kids. And Barry and various others, and I saw Watson, and they were blown away. They didn't know anything about data analytics.
Mm-hmm.
They don't even know what it is. They say, how is it appropriate to Africa? Of course, it's hugely, you know. They say, I want to be an agricultural engineer. How is this relevant to me? Is how they would put it to me. But guys, you know, these are kids, these are top tier kids from low income communities. When I say top tier, what I mean is ambitious, energetic, university track, going into like math and engineering and that kind of thing.
Is it because they don't have access to these technologies?
Yes.
Well,
we're access online all the time. Like we, you know, if we were in, say, a dinner or something, I mean, it's bad behavior, but we, you know, maybe we were throwing around an idea and I threw out a statistic and you'd say, no, I don't agree with you. And I get online and I check it out.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They don't do that. They're not online all the time. So some of the career advice is just, guys, you've got to get a grip on your career pathway and start doing the following kind of research, because nobody guides them to that.
Mm-hmm. Have you looked at and I know it's been a bit quiet lately, but I know the licensing process is coming up later this year. Government's plan to create a wholesale open access network. Have you looked at that? What are your thoughts on it?
You're going to get me into hot water with this one.
Good.
I'm not sure that I understand the purpose of a wholesale open access network in the context of a market that is not a monopoly. So in Mexico, which is maybe one of the only examples, it didn't work so well. And the logic there made sense because it is essentially in a monopoly environment that they're dealing with. We have a competitive environment. You know, Telcom is not what it was when I joined, when CIPO joined, basically. You know, whatever its issues are now, it is, you know, it's to be expected that Telcom would be going sort of in waves. And I'm sure that, you know, CIPO and team are going to bring it back. And you expect that it's the hardest part of the industry being a fixed line company. You know, it's a very difficult job. You're never going to have a straight line in that business, you know, straight line up. But it's still a thriving business. It's continuously opening. As you know, OpenServe is now offering naked, what do they call it?
Naked ADSL.
Naked ADSL, if people want to use ADSL. You know, there's a competitive market. They're all the operators are either buying from Telkom or buying from or building their own wholesale businesses, however they're supplied, and it's a competitive market. Mm. So what you've got to do is really get that competitive market working. I think where government policy needs to start focusing is there's a sense that you want small players in that rollout, and that might be useful because it does force a better behavior in the bigger players. But the reality is people are going to get upset with me saying this, but most players who open up generally are seeking to sell at some point. Mm. You know, the rollout, unless they are a, you know, just an infrastructure provider, maybe generally, you know, rolling out network is a scale business. It's best done at scale. So there's a lot of hype sometimes around these little Swan-A networks, but people don't realize somebody's paying for it. It's never free. Somebody's always paying for it. And generally, if it's just a little area, it is going to be more expensive. And when I joined Telkom, what I did was I tried to, you know, Telkom felt like a bit of a black box, you know, when SIPO came. Mm. And we were trying, as you know, because we met with you and various others to open up, meet with journalists more, communicate more, change our tone. That was, I mean, you might remember that in 2013 since you covered, you know.
Yes, I do.
And I used to bring some of these players to Telkom who were doing interesting things to say, you know, is this somebody we should partner with? And generally speaking, we found that they were more expensive than what we were doing. As expensive as Telkom was, they were more expensive, and that's what you'd expect when you're not buying in bulk and you're not rolling out in bulk. Then what you have to remember is that you have to maintain the network, you have to upgrade it continuously, and you have to monitor it. So who is going to do that? Right? So if you have a wholesale open access network, what I was going to say is, so then when you say we want to have all kinds of little players, what you're doing is you're fragmenting the competition. What you really want is three, maximum four telecommunications players that are hitting up against each other head to head and making sure that competition is healthy. A small market like ours, and particularly a stagnant one, probably can't cope with more. If you fragment it, what you're going to end up with is a dominant Vodacom. Mm-hmm. You're going to have one dominant player. That's what's going to happen. What you'd rather have is three or four really strong infrastructure players or a major wholesale provider. And then the competition comes when everybody has the broadband and you can encourage digital business on top of that. That's where the fabulous result is. So if everybody were in line with portable broadband, with accessible smartphones, then life would be very different in terms of entrepreneurial opportunity.
I mean, the government wanted to, in effect, get rid of infrastructure competition through this process because in the first draft of the WOAN, they wanted to ensure that all future spectrum is assigned to the WOAN and that the commercial operators then purchase capacity from that company. Yeah. But they've changed that rule subsequently, and now the ICASA is going to license spectrum to all operators who want it through an auction process. But there seem to be a view in government, and probably still exists in government, that infrastructure competition is a bad thing in the telecommunications industry. And I think there's been some sense seen here that infrastructure competition is actually a good thing because it keeps different operators on their toes. I suppose the question you need to ask is not so much do we have infrastructure competition, but how much infrastructure competition the market can support.
Right. So I was going to say in a perfect world, in one version of the world, infrastructure is a commodity or increasingly a commodity. You could try what Australia tried to do. I'm not sure that it worked out, where you have the NBN.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's worked.
Yeah, I don't know that worked. Mm. I mean, for a while there was a feeling that that was an answer. I'm not sure that it did work even for them. But that's one model where you say, look, infrastructure is actually a commodity. The state should just deliver it. That should not be the location for competition. Competition should be in services above that. That's one version of the world. Mm-hmm. That assumes that the state is good at delivering these kinds of services, and I don't know that that's true anywhere. I don't know that there's evidence of that. Even in China, you don't have that, where you've got a pretty strong functioning state. The benefit of having infrastructure, the other thing to remember about infrastructure is that it's not just a commodity. You probably know the expression smart pipes. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? In other words, the engineering involved, the continuous upgrading, the technological choices within that. The benefit of competition is to have that interplay. So that you might have one network that is better than the other.
Yes.
And competition within that. It isn't just a set of pipes.
And it's technology choices that have to be made. And if you have any one infrastructure provider and they make the wrong technology choice, then the whole market
then you're really in trouble.
Stuck. Yeah.
That's right. Because that's the foundation for the whole thing. So then you're really stuck if it turns out that you have a player that is rigid. And the thing that sometimes the state doesn't completely internalize is that rolling out telecommunications infrastructure is not like other infrastructure in the sense that there is continuous upgrading that happens. So government would often, it's a story I tell a lot, you know, they would often come to us and say, can you give us your network maps? And I wonder, well, I don't know what you would do with them. You know, you could have, I don't know if I want to give them, but if I did give them to you, next week we might change the way we're doing it. I mean, one of the changes we made at Telcom early on was to mix the mobile and the fixed network planning teams because they were operating like complete silos. So the idea was to create flexible network planning based, you know, that changes over time. Whereas before they just had the fixed rollout, then another team was doing the mobile rollout and they had nothing to do with each other. And then also bringing those teams together, they have a very different culture. One team is generally older and the mobile team is generally younger. Mm-hmm. You know, they have different ways of thinking about the world. They fight a lot, which I think is a good thing. Mm-hmm. And they would start saying, well, maybe we should have rather done LTE here or fiber or, and then the next week you might change your mind. That's how it has to work because the environment is changing so fast.
Yeah, just technology innovation and complexity and I mean, we've seen it before in the past, just on technology choices. We've seen networks deploying WiMAX technology. There was a view at one point that WiMAX may be the dominant mobile or wireless internet access service as opposed to 3G and 4G. And it wasn't clear which way it was going to go. And some operators invested in WiMAX and they failed.
And you could be wrong. So the benefit of being a telecom with a multiple technology company is that you have the opportunity. So as telecom gets stronger, I'm not advocating telecom anymore. I don't work there. Mm-hmm. But of course, you know, I feel connected to it. Having multiple technologies is a real strength that telecom over time has learned to leverage.
Yeah.
It took a while to get there because it's a big culture change.
Yeah. Miriam, I'm conscious of time, and I do want to talk to you a little bit about the lockdown as well. Let's not talk about tech for a couple of minutes. I want to get your views on the lockdown and how it's being managed broadly. I think people were broadly supportive of it when it was introduced, but as time has gone on, I think people are getting angrier about the economic fallout that we're starting to see, and I imagine that that anger is going to grow the longer this goes on for. Do you think we're taking too long with this lockdown? Do you think that the lockdown measures have been perhaps a little bit too draconian?
Well, we needed to do the lockdown, and actually, this can veer into a tech discussion.
All right.
Look, I set up a group of mostly policy economists and finance experts, to look at solutions around COVID. We've been working very closely with the presidency and treasury, and we set up a website to post stuff. So if I could just say what that website is, if you don't mind.
Of course.
So if I forget. But it's COVID-19economicideas.org. COVID-19economicideas.org. And it's just a total Tumamina group, and we've been working intensely since before the lockdown to come up with solutions on everything from macroeconomic strategies, with which we've been working very closely with Treasury, bond raising. We have a very big social impact bond we're working on, wage support proposals, loan bridging finance proposals, which, you know, was announced. And we have a health specialist who's working with us, and it's a whole group at VITS, and it's a multi-institutional thing. I'm a 4IR professor of practice at University of Johannesburg, and equally we have a team at VITS, UCT, Stellenbosch. It's a network of people who've come together. And just last night, in fact, we brought the economists and the health specialists together to talk about this. Now, the key issue, just to, so people understand, the idea that you eliminate the virus, you know that that's wrong, that's not going to happen. That's like eliminating the flu.
Yes.
You will have it. Yeah. So what you're after, and you've heard this many times, I'm sure, is about that flattening of the curve. And the purpose of the lockdown is to give time to, get strategies in place to manage, what's then called a risk-adjusted strategy, right? And a risk-adjusted strategy, this is where we get into the tech. The risk-adjusted strategy involves a range of things such as testing, you know, daily testing at a certain scale, and you need that information within 24 hours. Right now we're getting the information within 5 days, 5 to 7 days. Mm-hmm. So what I was told last night is that doesn't help you manage the virus. What that does is just tells you where you are. What you need is testing where you've got feedback within a day so that you can do contact tracing. What that means is then you need an app that is ubiquitous, that everybody has, that is doing contact tracing. And then you need a team that is doing contact tracing, right, that's following up. Then you need to be able to isolate. Right. Now, within that as well, there are other things that you need. You need, everybody should have masks if they're moving around, you know, sanitizer and all of that. Right. Now, the problem right now is that those risk adjusted strategies aren't yet in place. So if they lift the lockdown now, those strategies wouldn't be in place to manage the movement of people. Having said that, I'm not sure what the deadline is anymore.
Mm.
When is this supposed to end? If you're not putting the risk-adjusted strategies in place, then you don't need a lockdown. And I know that sounds contradictory. You have the lockdown, so you put them in place. So what we need to be asking, and I may be behind the curve, but I was in session with some top experts who were advising government on their health strategy last night, asking these questions. And what I was told was that these are not yet in place. And I'm not sure what the pathway is, what is the app that is going to be used? Mm. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Right? You basically need one app that is used by whoever, whether it's CSIR or it's NICD or whoever, and you need the testing that has a turnaround of 12 to 24 hours so that you can act on it. And then you've got to reach 80% of the contacts of that person within the past, I don't know, few days, I guess. And then you've got to catch up with them and see who did they connect with. And you know that I'm sure you've seen that and your listeners have seen that. Then you know, you can do that electronically. That's the main way of doing that. Now that's not yet in place. It may be that my information's behind. I don't think so, but it may be behind. And so the question that people should be asking is, where is that? Because we certainly have the know-how to do it. We certainly have the technological capability. I would worry about the privacy issues and that the appropriate protections are in place. And also I would want to know that the people who are going to be isolating whoever have been trained appropriately, so we don't see this kind of stuff that we've been seeing in the township or arresting surfers kind of nonsense. Right?
Yeah.
You need people who have been trained in how to do this kind of thing. Mm. The next thing that I worry about is the way that the townships are being managed. This is something that I'm writing about right now. I'll put out a paper in the next couple of days about all the things that I'm talking about right now. When you see the way that the townships have been managed, it is a real concern, and I think it's our number one risk, aside from what I've just raised. And what that means is we need community-appropriate strategies. What worries me in the townships is that they're using the suburbs model of home-based isolation, which is physically, it's just not possible. And so when you impose rules that are almost impossible to comply with. So, for example, my brother, who's a doctor in Canada, told me that alcohol was the fifth most important essential item in Canada. Because apparently, if you're an alcoholic and you stop drinking, you can die. That's how he explained it to me. Yeah. Whereas smoking, nobody else has stopped smoking, but you don't die. You just get frustrated. So smoking, alcohol, you end up with a bootleg. I mean, we know that from prohibition. You end up with an illegal tax avoiding.
And we're seeing it already.
And illegal trade is a very dangerous business as well for communities. It's very dangerous, physically dangerous. So the issue about the townships is that something that is impossible to implement has been imposed, and that means that people will ignore it,
mm-hmm.
right? It's just human nature. You're sharing a tap, you're sharing toilets. What you need are approaches that, like our lockdown maybe is okay for us, relatively speaking. But in townships, it's physically impossible. Mm-hmm. And what worries me is that if there is an outbreak, one liquor store raid or one lineup for a grant or food parcels with a couple people who are infected unknowingly, we know how fast this spreads. One thing like that could then spread. Because we're not testing at the right scale, we wouldn't know.
Mm.
And because we don't have lockdown methodologies, if there was a spread, we wouldn't be able to necessarily effectively lock down, say, a block, that type of thing. You could be, for example, isolating certain parts of blocks where people have common services or something like that, and saying that's your isolation area. You could be saying food parcels will deliver them to the top of your block, and you identify who's gonna. Maybe one of the kids or a few of the kids take it down the block and deliver the food parcel. Same with a social grant, something like that. So that you're thinking about approaches that can work. For a period of time, the informal traders were only allowed to sell fruit and vegetables. So what do you want them to do? What if you need meat? What if you need a light bulb?
Mm.
People in townships don't have stocks. I've got a few pairs of shoes. What if your shoes break and you only have one pair?
Yeah.
What if your kettle breaks? What if your stove breaks? What difference does it make what you buy?
Yeah.
So my fear is that, aside from what I was raising about risk-adjusted strategies, is that if something happens in the townships, which I think is possible, I don't know if you've been seeing what's recently happened in Mumbai.
No, I haven't.
Okay, so there was an explosion of infections recently in Mumbai, and you know what the living conditions can be like there?
Yeah.
In slums. Actually, in Russia, there have been a few outbreaks lately where the numbers have just exploded. That can easily happen in South Africa, and we wouldn't have methodologies in place that would enable the containment if that were, if and when that were to happen. Mm. So the thing is that what we should be doing is we should be enabling. So I'm speaking about the health risks issue because it's connected to the economic issues. At the same time, we're locking down. I'm not sure that it's completely aligned. It needs to be far more aligned with the idea of physical distancing, right? So what I'm saying, you know, we had spoken offline about e-commerce as an example.
I was about to come to that.
Yeah, well, e-commerce, by definition, is physical distance.
Yes.
Right? And those guys have been trained. The guys who've been delivering, so I've been ordering online, they all apply a certain kind of, you know, they take a picture of what they've given you, you don't sign anything, you prepay. You know, there are all kinds of methods. They stay away from you. You pick it up yourself and they walk away from you. You know, all of that kind of thing. They're wearing masks. It's very, so far anyway, it's very professional. And I've been kind of doing it on purpose because I want to see what everybody's doing. So I order stuff from different places. I see how long it takes. I'm just curious. So I need stuff, but I'm also buying from different places because I'm curious to see what happens.
Yeah.
What the customer service is like, what they do, how long it takes, et cetera. Now, you should be able to buy anything online. If I want to buy a trampoline, if I want to buy whatever it is, because you know the benefit, Duncan, firstly, is that it keeps the economy, firstly, it means that you can have what you need. Mm-hmm. Secondly, it means money's flowing. So traditional retailers are getting much more jacked up. I've noticed in the past week, for some reason, things have suddenly improved with the food retailers. You know, Woolworths, Pick and Pay, and those ones. I've been checking. I'm just interested in the area.
You mean in their e-commerce deliveries?
Yeah. They were really bad.
Yeah.
Last month. I mean, theoretically, they had the service, but they'd say, we'll deliver it to you after the lockdown. And I go, I don't know why I need to order food after the lockdown. You know, I'll go buy it myself. So I haven't been buying, but lately, I don't know what's going on, but this past week, something has improved. And I've been asking around, but I'm not sure what happened. Mm-hmm. But something improved in the past week.
Interesting. I know that both Pick and Pay and Woolworths have partnered with third-party companies. I forget the company that Woolworths has partnered with, but Pick and Pay partnered with Bottles, which is an alcohol delivery app, and they've repurposed their business and are now delivering essentials from Pick and Pay. And I think that may be perhaps one of the reasons you've seen an improvement in service.
But I've ordered spices from Durban and, you know, like just different things. Okay. And it's all been pretty good. You know, they've still got to get away, but they're not telling, you know, they've got a way to go on customer service.
Yes.
Timeliness and all of that, but it's okay. And, very professional. And they're not telling me anymore that I'll get it after the lockdown. Mostly.
Yeah.
Still a mixed bag, but mostly. So, now the question is, why can't I just buy an airplane? You know, like, why can't I buy whatever it is that I want to buy? What happens if you do that? Is firstly, by definition, it's physical distancing. If retailers have it in stock in particular, it means that it generates cash. They're able to pay some of their suppliers off. There's less chance of business failure. You know, one of the things I have in mind is, you know, a lot of the work we've done so far, we're called the COVID-19 Economist Group. Couldn't think of a more creative name. And you know, what we've been mostly focused on to begin with is how you make sure that you limit business failure and slow down retrenchment, because you don't want a temporary problem to become a permanent one unnecessarily. So once you let people go, firms will learn how to work without them. That's what I think will happen. I think we're going to end up with a generally higher unemployment rate if we continue in this way.
Well, Miriam, I was chatting to the CEO of quite a large JSE-listed company not long ago, and he said, you know, all this work from home is fantastic because now I can see who I actually need and who I don't.
Exactly. So, you know, I think it's going to lead to efficiency improvement, but the reality is we have an unemployment challenge in this country, and we can't, you know, yeah, you want the productivity improvement, but people need to be employed. We need money flowing in the economy, livelihoods. There's all kinds of reasons. So the issue now is that what you want companies to do is to draw down on their stocks and their inventory, earn some cash so they can pay off some bills, so their suppliers don't go bust. And then when we get back to activity, then they have to restock. If you carry on like this, you're going to end up with fire sales, which you can see all over the place right now, for anybody who's allowed to sell. And when you get back to business, well, they still have the stuff, they still have the stock. So it's either a fire sale or whatever, but they're not buying. So part of what you want to do in this economic solution is you want to slow down the rate of retrenchment, slow down the rate of business failure. And a lot of firms were already on a precipice before COVID. And then you want to push the economic rebound as much as you can. And drawing down on inventories now will help the, will help stimulate the rebound as well. So there's all sorts of reasons why that should happen. Whether you should say that physical retailers should be able to sell anything, I know some people would say that, you may end up with crowding around. I don't know what it means. When I see it in Woolworths and you see people can buy clothes, I don't know, can they try them on? I don't know how that works exactly.
I don't know.
You know, people are touching it and picking it up. So I'm kind of thinking, I don't know that I have nothing. I'm just raising Woolworths because I was in the shop recently and I saw people shopping for clothes. You know, I think maybe online is the thing. Now the problem is that not everybody's online. Most e-commerce, as you know, happens, you probably know, still happens through credit card usage. We still don't have a very strong kind of mobile money approach. What worries me also is that this was an amazing opportunity to be thinking more creatively about getting government services online. And there was some thinking around the grants work, the social grants, about strengthening fintech. A lot of discussion with BASA, the Business Banking Association of South Africa. There was a lot of discussion around how we could strengthen fintech around the social grant provision. I'm not sure what happened there. But that's the kind of thing that this thing should stoke. We should be having more discussions around how we get services online, you know, food parcel distribution and tracking, getting the, as I said, the contact tracing done, the digital business, e-enabling informal retailers in townships, maybe starting to get warehousing sorted out. The enabling of that would be absolutely transformational. You might have fewer cashiers in stores and fewer people in front line of retail, but you would have more people, you know, in warehousing and certainly more business entry. You know, as you see in services like Alibaba, it's so transformative in a highly concentrated economy to have online sales where you have far more access to market. You've got this channel to market that you didn't have before.
What is your take on Ibrahim Patel's, the Minister of Trade and Industries, assertion that it would be seen to be unfair to allow unfettered e-commerce when physical retailers are not permitted to sell non-essential items?
Well, they can sell non-essential items if they sell it online. They do sell online. Most major retailers sell is the first thing. The second thing is, as I said, is actually I think small businesses and emerging businesses would be fantastically stimulated, which is what we need in this economy, is to get more competition in most markets, not just telecommunications.
Yeah.
It's an incredibly concentrated economy. And the retailers, while, you know, have been maybe upping their game a bit, you know, still buy as corporates need to, still that the tenancy will always be to find, you know, more efficient ways of delivering, and that will generally be in bulk.
Yes.
And so e-retailing offers that opportunity, you know, like that Alibaba story, for fantastic entry for all kinds of players, you know, to be selling. So I think actually it would create more competition if it were stimulated and people were encouraged to get online. I think it's an incredible opportunity to start getting more behavioral change.
Yes. Yeah, it's interesting that we had Kim Reed, from the CEO of Takealot, on this show just a couple of weeks ago, and he made the point that China actively encouraged e-commerce delivery in Wuhan, which was the original epicenter of this of the coronavirus. And his view is that we're crazy not to do the same.
Well, you know, it helps when you're in China, where everybody is online.
Yeah.
Everybody. Where everybody buys products online already. So when you say, and food delivery is huge in China. Everybody buys through Alibaba,
mm-hmm.
you know, or JD.com or something like that. So, you know, they already have the foundation. And that's what I meant when I say this period exposes that problem, and it's an enormous opportunity to start shifting people online. It would be so transformative. You see, part of the thing also is that people live long distances. I'm stating the obvious, but people live long distances to market. It costs money to get there, it costs money to get to a government service. So the more you're offering services online, and the more that government is in the cloud, and that these kinds of services are in the cloud, and that people can pay online, etc., the lower transaction costs will be, the lower, the less money people will have to spend on transport. It'll bring the cost of living down. It'll bring the cost of doing business down. It's exactly consistent with what the NDP's ethos was.
Yeah. The Minister of Communications, the currently suspended Minister of Communications, uses almost every speech she gives to talk about 4IR, Fourth Industrial Revolution.
Yeah.
President has often talked about 4IR in his speeches as well, and as have various other cabinet ministers. But we've now come to the crunch. Unfettered e-commerce is banned. Were all these references to 4IR simply meaningless platitudes?
Well, you know, I think they do want to see that transformation. And again, most governments use that terminology, but still have a long way to go. Not just this government, many governments struggle to get what it's actually about. When people use the term 4IR, which is not my favorite expression, I'll have to say.
Mine either.
But if you use the term 4IR, it really refers to a cultural change. It's not actually a technological thing. It refers to a different way of living, a different way of being, a different way of thinking, and digitalization is some part of that. Right?
Yeah.
This kind of approach is very command and control. And there's a level at which, you know, you have to, you know, coming down hard also does create the kind of behavioral change you want. If you didn't come down hard, people would not have responded in this way, which was needed. I think people are taking this very seriously now. The difference is in the townships, we have to be doing it differently. This strategy should have changed ages ago.
Mm-hmm.
But 4IR is a different way of being. That's the conversation that has to happen. It's a different way of thinking about policy and of commerce. Like, I think that you know, what often gets referred to as Takealot, and I've also spoken to Kim over this period.
Yeah.
You know, they'll say, oh, but Takealot sort of dominates that environment. But that's not really what the point is. First, the e-commerce is actually pretty small, so you can't really say Takealot's dominant.
Mm.
I mean, what... You know, e-commerce in total, I could be wrong, but is it more than 2% of the entire retail market? I don't think so.
No, I don't think it's even that big yet.
I think it's less. I think it might be 1.5%. So actually, it's just a tiny little space in the retail market that you would like to see more of. You'd like to enable more players to be coming up in this environment, and firms would be enabled through that and get moving. And then take a lot. The point is not take a lot. The point is the sales that happen through take a lot is the point. Mm. The competition is not take a lot. The competition is that you enable all these people to sell their stuff, whether it's take a lot, loot, whatever it is. There are actually quite a range of players.
There's a lot of players. Take a lot is the biggest, but it's by no means dominant.
Well, and it's not dominant of retail is the other point.
Yeah.
So to say, well, you know, we think it's anti-competitive, it's kind of, well, actually, you'd give them a leg up and you'd give other players a leg up and you would start having still tiny but small, but enabled competition from true e-commerce players with your incumbents. That's what would happen. You'd give them a leg up. You know, the analogy, I guess, is in the old days, telecom versus the mobile players, where you say telecom has all these obligations and all these restrictions so that the mobile players can get a leg up. Now they're the dominant players, and some of the work I did at telecom was to represent the fact that telecom was no longer the dominant player and still had the same imposed requirements. Having said that, as you know, there was a period in the 1990s that said, let's contain telecom, the monopoly at the time, and let's give the mobile players a chance. The same thing needs to happen around this, and this is an opportunity to do that. So I do see it differently.
Yeah, interesting stuff. Miriam, we could talk for the rest of the afternoon, but I'm conscious of the time, so I think we're going to wrap up there, and I will let you go. But always great to talk to you. Miriam Altman is a commissioner at the National Planning Commission. She is also the director of Altman Advisory and has many other roles as well. Miriam, thanks so much for your time. It was great to chat.
Thanks. Yeah, as always. Thanks.